Welcome back to Art Smack. I'm your host, Jerry Gagosian, joined with my co-host,
Matt Capasso. And we have a very special episode for you guys this week. But before we dive into the episode, I wanted to take a moment to thank some of our sponsors that we've recently acquired for the show. Jerry, do you want to hear some of the sponsors? You want me to do a little shout out?
I mean, I don't really care as long as their checks keep coming in, but yeah, sure. Go ahead.
I want to start off by thanking Phillips Auction House, our sponsor, one of my three favorite auction houses out there. Thank you, Phillips. I also want to thank, there's a new nonprofit we've been working with, and they've been really supportive throughout this. It's a recent one. It's formed within the last few weeks. It's called the Art Advisor Legal Defense Fund, and it's a group that is looking to ensure that art advisors in New York City get the support that they need for any future and oncoming legal battles. At this moment in time, they're not actually accepting cash donations, but rather paid-in-kind donations of luxury handbags, watches, jewels, and luxury condos in Tribeca. And Chardonnay, bottles of Chardonnay. I also want to thank another sponsor, which is Beeple. You know Beeple?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I barely remember him.
But he decided to sponsor the show, and it's really a way for him to give back to the art world, which has been so kind to him. For him, it's really incredible how rich and famous and wealthy we've made him, his children, his children's children, and his children's children's children forever and eternity for, you know, getting his word out there for his artwork. And lastly, he's back. Our final sponsor is Inigo Philbrick Gallery. Yeah.
I didn't know he was back.
He's back. So he's opening up a new gallery. He's taking over the old Nodler gallery space.
Oh, okay. Great.
So you might have known Nodler from the Netflix.
Super fitting.
The Netflix documentary. So Inigo is really going to have a real laser focus with this gallery. The exhibition platform is going to be focused on a few movements in art. It's going to be works by the fraudists, neo-scamism. Mm-hmm. And then works by artists in the Ponzi scheme school.
Oh, so contemporary art.
Contemporary art. So that was our sponsors. Thank you, sponsors.
Thank you. You can send us that money via Venmo, Cash App, or Zelle.
So Jerry, what's on the docket for this week?
Well, obviously we're going to talk about Freeze. We're going to talk about Ethereal Femmes, the Max Glam Ball that we had at the Boom Room. We're going to be going over the Lisa Schiff court case, which is ongoing as promised. There were a few more documents that were made public via this magical website called
the New York Court Search.
.gov.
I think it's .gov.
.gov, where we've been able to stay abreast to all the sworn affidavits coming in and bankruptcy filings and whatnot. So lots of juice there. Have to say, really, you know, I do believe innocent until proven guilty, but it's not looking so good for Lisa Schiff.
Don't spoil it. We're going to get
we'll get really into it. And then we're getting...
There's been some legal decisions by the Supreme Court related to art and Andy Warhol specifically, which we'll touch on briefly.
Well, if it has anything to do with appropriating imagery, mm-hmm. I'm fucked.
All right. Welcome back to Art Smack. So guys, we just wrapped up Freeze New York this week. It was a whirlwind, as all these art fairs usually are. I'm going to kick this over to you, Jerry, for the first question. Mm-hmm. I'm going to challenge you.
Okay.
I want you to sum up Freeze New York Week in one word and then explain why.
Can I have two words?
You can have two words if they're hyphenated.
Can I just have two words?
Yes, you can have two words.
My two words are too much.
Too much. Go on, elaborate.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, I mean, obviously there was TAFAF, right? Mm-hmm. And The Independent.
Right.
And then there was the Ethereal Femmes art talk series that we did. And
thank you for having me to be a part of. It was very fun.
You did a great
Shout out to Sanford Biggers and Shabalala Self. You guys were awesome. It's a great time at the Standard East Village. Appreciate it.
And then there was the Ethereal Femmes Ball, which was beautiful for everyone involved, I think.
Oh, it was a blast. So much fun. So much positive feedback. Yeah. We had a great time. No issues. It was just awesome.
I got to dress as a leaf. I was a giant Monstera leaf. However, the dress that they sent me was straight off the runway. So while I do fancy myself a thin fit woman, I don't know if I have the exact size of a 6 foot, 90 pound model. So that was a tight ass Monstera leaf I was wearing. I didn't breathe the whole night, but I had a really great time. My mom came, and I think my mom won best costume.
Tell everybody what she dressed up
my
as.
My mom was making me cringe a little at first because I was like, Mom, what's your costume? And she was being aloof. She was like, oh, you know, like I'm going to be a Viking Valkyrie. And love you, Mom. And she listens to the podcast. But I don't know how much she knows about what a Valkyrie really is. Because a Valkyrie, it's not like something beautiful. A Valkyrie used to be sent, is from Nordic mythology, and a Valkyrie would go down, be sent by like Odin to go down to the battlefield and kill warriors so they could take them up to, you know, Valhalla, not so that they could like hang out in heaven. It was so that they could, like, for all eternity fight on Odin's battlefield.
Fighting men's wars.
Yeah. So it's not like being a Valkyrie is a great thing. And by the way, my name, Hildy, is a Valkyrie. So, like, it's also the old Germanic word feminized for the word battle. Mm-hmm. So, again, like, it's just very funny because it's not like warrior princess or something. It's just the word battle. But anyways, Jane, my mother, was like, I'm going to be a Valkyrie. And I'm like, okay. And she's like, an angel Valkyrie. And I'm like, Mom, I mean, it's not Christianity here. Like, it's not like being a Valkyrie. And I say, I'm very curious, like, what is this going to be? And we had a makeup artist come for her, and she had like this blackened, smoked eye all the way across her face.
It reminded me of Natalie Portman from Black Swan.
Yes.
That makeup. Yeah.
And then she had this, it was a wedding dress actually that her friend let her borrow or gave her. It's like an old wedding dress that she then took a black corset and wore like over the top. And then she took IKEA lace curtains. And she had Viking horns that she wrapped fairy lights around and then put the IKEA curtains like over her horns, like draping her whole outfit. I mean, she looked unbelievable. She looked amazing. And as well as everyone came dressed, and there was some amazing costumes. Like there was this one girl, I don't know her, but she came in like all pearls with this incredible crown. Another girl came dressed in like, she said it was like a sustainable Met Gala costume, and it was all made out of like a bag of lemons. So like the dried lemons.
I didn't see that person.
Were like the top part of her dress. The bag that it came in turned into like a veil that slightly like covered her head and was a hat. It was like amazing. Like everyone really wore their costumes. It was fun. You looked amazing with your
I wore a suit.
With your suit with a flower in it.
I had to do something a little special.
Yes. And
I wore one of your earrings.
Yes. Yeah. We had a really good time. The dinner was great. The ball was great. And then there was Freeze, of course, the fair, which we went to
Wednesday
for the VIP opening, and
it was at the Shed, which it was last year, I think, too.
At the Shed again. And, you know, it was It was all right. It was fine.
Did you get a sense of how dealers, we always like to check in whenever you go to these fairs. Like, did you get a sense of how the dealers were feeling? Were they happy with sales? Was there any sort of, oh, well, I don't know.
I didn't talk a lot to the dealers about where they were at. Of course I was paying attention, but
they seemed happy. They seemed
fine. But if the auctions this season are any indicator of what's going on in the market, and we have read a few articles now that have come out basically stating that the New York art market is cooling.
I would say, just to make it a little bit more nuanced, it's the secondary market auction houses for these big estate collections from these mega collector types. It seemed like there was an oversupply perhaps this season. And then when you compound it with not just Christie's, but also Sotheby's and also Phillips bringing all this property to market, some of the sales were disappointing. That was kind of the feeling we got just talking to people. You know, we went to dinners, we were talking with some people that were in the room, talking about how it wasn't that exciting. And then, you know, a shout out to—
And we watched Sotheby's ourselves.
Yeah, it was boring. It was
very lackluster, and they were hitting, like, some were below the estimate prices. Some were coming in just at the estimate, and very few were going above.
And I would say a lot of them were just hammering the phrase selling at the first person that bid. So yeah. The guy would, Ollie Barker, the auctioneer, would open up the lot. He'd do his fake chandelier bidding, which we got a good kick out on the video.
It's so obvious.
And then the first person that would grab it, they'd put their hands up and take it at $3 million. I got it. You have it at $3 million. And then
he'd hold it for like 5 minutes. And we're like, dude.
Yeah, be like, anyone else? Anyone else? And then it'd be like 30 seconds. Anyone else? Any advance from the gentleman on the right here? Anyone in advance? No? Please? Give me. Come on. Karen, please give me. Yeah. Give me the next bid. Please give me.
And he
Karen,
wasn't saying please. Give me. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Just give me.
Give me. We're like, excuse me.
And then he would drag it on for like 3 minutes of just a single bid and then end up selling it there. And that's choreographed. I don't know how much people know about this. I mean, they more or less know where the bids are going to come from.
Yeah.
But sometimes they hope that they have a feeling. Maybe John Nottingdale from London will come and bid on this one. So we got to make sure we give him enough time to think about it. Yeah. That was kind of happening there.
Yeah.
But it's not a good sign. It wasn't robust bidding. I can confirm that.
So, and the works at Freeze this year were, the fun thing was, is I actually saw some newer things, even at like the major galleries. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was interesting to see a whole booth of Nan Golden at like a major art fair. Mm-hmm. Robert Nava had like—
Yeah, he owned Pace that day.
He had the entire Pace booth.
Interaction with him.
Yeah.
I think you should recap it for us because it was hilarious.
No, well, Robert Nava sent me the most beautiful love letter last summer.
After you had in fun joked and made fun of him a little bit.
But he wrote me this beautiful letter, which I've saved, that said something along the lines of, thank you for teaching me how to laugh at myself. Mm-hmm. And that was completely disarming, obviously, mm-hmm. to me, because I had been cracking on him and his work for so long. And then he and I were introduced through a mutual friend, and we went for this really long walk. And it turns out that he and my brother actually have like something very similar, which is like deep passion for like wrestling, like is it WWF or WWE?
It's WWE. It was okay. WWF in the 90s, but okay, it's WWE okay. now.
So it's WWE. So like, and he loves it, and I grew up around it, so I know like all the characters and Vince McMahon and
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
And Stone Cold Steve Austin. And so this summer, Robert and I, we became friends, and we became friends on this long walk down the beach where we were sort of like role playing, talking, you know, like the talking shit back and forth that they always have before the wrestling matches. Well, he and I were like, we actually joked about doing a series back and forth on Jerry, like where like we'd come on and be like, I challenge you. you know.
Your pansy ass.
Yeah. And so every time I see, I mean, he, now we're buddies and he always sends me like, and I send him like anytime we see like really good, really funny, like, because those videos were crazy. Like,
yeah,
like
pure entertainment.
There's this one that he sent me that like, I can't even believe it's real. I don't understand. It's literally like Stone Cold Steve Austin or something, like beating the shit out of an 80-year-old woman. And you know it's not real because it's this fake wrestling thing, but it looks real. And they're like body slamming her and like throwing her around. And it's just so funny because it's a circus, you know? Mm-hmm. And the way that they used to, you know, talk shit to each other, which, you know, Matt and I, we also were watching some videos recently. And we tried to watch current WWE wrestling. And it's just not cutting the mustard. Like, it's not as, like, it was funny. It was funny. Like, Vince, like, smelling the money in his briefcases and stuff. Anyway, Robert and I have this just ongoing joke. So he was in the Pace booth. So I entered.
Entire booth was for his work.
So I entered it like I was a pro wrestler and I was coming on his territory. And I started talking shit to him and he kind of like refused to talk shit back to me. But then at one point he pretended to call security to get me escorted out of the Pace booth. So we had a good time. I ran into my, I won't say my say any names here, but my, the penultimate of senior directors who I actually wrote about during the Art Basel, the Art Basel Jerry Report. And I had said that, you know, I admired her because while, you know, everybody was sitting around flipping on their iPads, there were a few smart people who could read the room and understand we lived under recessionary times and it was time to work hard because, as we know, Art Basel in Miami didn't do as well as people would like to lead you to believe. And so this queen was working on her feet and, you know, she's been in the game for 30 plus years. And I'd written about this, just witnessing her and all of her senior director glory. And I wasn't being sarcastic. And I also didn't mention her name in the report. Mm-hmm. And I ran into her with this collector friend who basically was one of the people who kept my old gallery alive. There's this art angel, Beth DeWitty. And I ran into the senior director with Beth and I said hi to Beth, of course. And then she asked me how I was doing. I said, very well. And I said, she said, so I read what you wrote about Miami. And I was like, oh no, she's going to think that I was like being like an asshole or insincere, but I really meant it. Like the woman works, you know, and like, she knows how to sell. And I was, and it's something to be admired when you're in this game for so long.
Right.
Like, because it's so easy to not give a shit and just expect that everyone's going to come to you, especially if you're coming from a major blue chip gallery or whatever, you have the thing that's in demand. I love to see a senior director in action. And she goes to me, I may not be perfect, but no one. And she kind of put her finger in my face. She goes, no one works as hard as I do in this industry. And I was like, oh, I love you even more. I love you even more. Because she is like the senior director of senior directors that I dream of. So, I, you know, that was fun. It was fun to – it's summer camp. But, I mean, it is fucking summer camp every 4 weeks at this point. I mean, we see each other too much.
You saw – you started to outline it. I mean, you had – Tafaf, Independence, you had Freeze.
And then there was Nada, which Nada, I didn't go – I didn't have – I was too tired
break,
to go
even
to.
Spring Break did something in New York this week. I mean, you're looking at five events that and I mean, there was other satellite fairs that took place. I think Volta or something. So there's just like a lot of art stuff going on that week. But we made it through. You know, I would say from Freeze, my experience, hate the shed. Don't really enjoy it. I think it's very awkward and weird to have an art fair there with the elevator situation or escalator situation.
Yeah. I think and a lot of people have said, I think we missed it because I think we just went upstairs and had a coffee before we left. But the top floor of galleries was like not completely full. It was like very sparse, and it was sort of, a few people said it felt like all the afterthought galleries that like no one really cared about, which I don't even know what galleries were up there. So I'm not even throwing shade to them, but like that room wasn't even full. And then it really only felt like it was popping on the first floor,
which is where all the big New York blue chip galleries were, the Pace, Hauser, all those.
Exactly.
And then all the other ones in that range.
Yeah.
Yeah. We talked to the Hauser people. I mean, I made the joke. I was like, so that's available, right? That work's available. And without even laughed at me. They just laughed at me. It wasn't even like, no, I'm sorry.
No, they don't even laugh. They smile.
They smile. Yeah. It was like a little smirk. I was like, I love that work. Is it available?
They're like, get the fuck out of here.
I walking through, nothing, you know, knocked my socks off from the Freeze booths.
I liked the Hyundai gallery.
Hyundai. Yeah.
Hyundai gallery.
What about the Seoul Kia gallery?
They had this, and you were so right on the money. I spotted them first, and I brought you over. There were these beautiful paintings of waterfalls. Mm. And you were like, this would be like if Monet had painted waterfalls. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's lovely. That's beautiful. There's so many like artists that paint in the vein of Picasso. There's so many artists that paint in the vein of, throw it out there, you know, like some abstract expressionist, or even like,
oh, do you remember that Pollock, the Follick we saw?
Yeah, there's bad Pollocks, aka Follicks, but you don't hear a lot of people say like this artist paints in the vein of Monet, like. That's lovely. That's actually a beautiful compliment.
That's high praise.
Yeah.
I just wanted to quickly bring up when I was interviewing Sanford and Shabalala, I think I posed to them a question about artists that they identify with. And actually, Sanford said that Monet was one of his guys, which I thought was very interesting, just thinking about his work in relation to Monet's. Yeah. Hyundai did a great job. They usually do, I would say.
Yeah.
The Korean galleries, it's
all
like a theme
the
on
Korean
the
galleries. Kujay is always really good.
I mean, they're bringing it the most I've seen. So I would agree with you. I enjoyed that booth. Besides that, I mean, could you think of anything else from the emerging side? I mean, there was any booths that really were, you know, standouts? I liked the
Nan Golden. I think, I mean, obviously photography is incredibly out of vogue. Yeah. It's not like the popular medium right now, but someone like her with such a long history and genuinely such a large body of work, which is, I don't even, how old is Nan now? She's in her 60s or 70s, and she's been taking photos since she was in her late teens. 50 years, it's an incredible span, and they're not just the pictures that she's like iconically known for. Now they've changed and evolutionized and morphed. And I actually would like to see more photography. There is incredible, obviously this is a duh statement, but there's incredible photographers that we should see more of. I mean, yes, painting is great, but photography is also wonderful.
I used to, when I was first getting really into contemporary art, Greg Crudson was a big artist that I just loved. I loved his approach to photography, film sets, and the eerie nature of them.
James Cohen? He had a great booth.
Yeah, James Cohen had a great booth as well.
There, I mean, I'm going to actually write about it, obviously, for the Jerry Report. So if you're not signed up, go to gagosian.com and become a member. Join the club. Join Jerry. I'm not sure what the exact language is on the website, but it's very obvious. Join the mailing list. It's $10 a month or $30 a month, depending on where you
– what status
what your commitment to my writing is and – And I'll go in more depth, actually, because I do have a pretty substantial list of individual works.
Right.
I wouldn't say booth-wise, I think because it's a soft market, there was a lot of, like, lower, I think like lower priced or mid-range priced works. And everyone, except for very, very few exceptions, had like these group show type things. There wasn't a lot of commitment to one artist or two artists. Yeah, it was like you'd walk in.
Jack Whitten and Hauser, I think. Was that
but,
Jack Whitten?
But other than like the big guys, but like even you go into like Periton or something, it's like.
Oh, hodgepodge.
It's like 10 artists. None of the works make sense together. I mean, I guess they don't have an obligation to quote unquote curate it, but you know, it's just kind of like, I feel like they're throwing out whatever they can sell.
Let me ask you, Hilde Gallery is still alive today. You have a chance to exhibit in Frieze. Would you bring one artist? Would you bring a mix? What would be your preference?
I would probably bring a mix, but I would curate it.
A mix, but curated. Instead of just, here's the latest work from our buzziest artist on the roster, et cetera.
Yeah, no, right. I would curate it. But I always thought, and I guess when you get to a certain level, certain status, and you've been showing with these fairs for a long time, I don't think they look so hard at the application. Like, I think they're like,
oh, no.
I think they're just
it's
like,
a shoe-in.
They're just like, oh, you've shown with us before. You can afford it. You're showing X, X, and X artists. Those are all big names. You're good. Come on in. It would be cool to see more curatorial sort of standards in the work, but are in these things. But I think like asking a gallery to do that is putting way too much pressure on these otherwise, besides like the mega galleries that really have the machines put in place for this. Otherwise, these galleries are incredibly overworked, spread super thin, traveling constantly, going like, from art fair to art fair.
Let me just say, the big galleries, they have art fair teams,
like
dedicated people. Even the upper, you know, what do you call it? Like below blue chip. What's that phrase?
Mega minus.
Mega minus. Like they don't have gallery. I mean, they might have someone who's designated for it, but they don't have a team of six people that is purely art fair focused.
Yeah.
Like some of the other big ones are. So even for them, it's pretty difficult to get around every 6 weeks to put together a show, ship it, sell it.
It's so much.
Staff it. Yeah.
It's so much. And it's so expensive. It's prohibitively expensive.
Right. So I want to wrap up this segment when just going back to the auction results and trying to up-level this and think about its implications. So we have some data. Certainly auctions were disappointing. You know, my take, and then I would love to hear your take about what it means and what happened, is that I think interest rate hikes by the Fed are having an effect in all global markets. I think debt is more expensive now and people have other obligations and there's a level of belt tightening. And I think when you compound that with the massive glut and supply of, I would say, high quality artworks and big collections that came this May, you had an oversupply and under demand. And I think that was really the dynamic that took place there.
And I don't know which article it was that I was reading, but somebody was being interviewed actually about this. I don't think we're saying anything new actually, because I'm just remembering a friend of mine sent me an article and they were asking like, why do you think the art market is soft, like it is right now? Why do you think the art market's cooling in New York? And the person that they were interviewing, I think was from like Lehman Maupin Gallery. Mm-hmm. And they were like, well, you know, if you look at it, like they tied it into, their answer tied into real estate. They're like, less people are buying homes because interest rates are so high. So if less people are buying homes, because there was so many people buying homes during the pandemic because they were leaving the cities and no one knew how long it was going to be. So they didn't want to be trapped in New York, LA, whatever. So they were buying their second, third, fourth homes, filling them with art, which I thought this was very funny, because if you were to ever walk into a gallery and say, that painting would make a wonderful decoration in my home, they would fucking throw you out of the gallery. Right. But here we are, like in some rather important publication, the name eludes me right now, but they're literally saying like, well, people aren't buying enough homes, so they don't need to decorate. Like they didn't use the word decorate, but they might as well have.
Right.
So, and I do think it is tied to interest rates. And finally, I mean, I'm finally hearing even my more well-to-do friends genuinely complain about like feeling the pain of inflation. Because we've been feeling it and, you know, other people have been feeling it for much longer. But, you know, for a certain class of people, it takes longer for that to catch up. And I think finally, and I'm not saying this gleefully for anyone, because if they're finally feeling it, imagine what it feels like to be very, I don't want to use the word poor, but like when money really matters.
When you're going to the grocery store and you're feeding families and you're filling up your car to get to work frequently, like this is where inflation really strikes the hardest.
But it's also finally hitting the art world and the art buying side.
I think so. I just want to be a little nuanced. It's certainly hitting the secondary auction, these million plus dollar items, these big collections. The effect of it on primary works of art from galleries is anecdotal at best. And that is because, as I've always said, and it's the truth, when we talk about the art market, our visibility into it is limited to maybe 50 or so percent of what's actually being transacted, because auction results get public, but you know what's selling at the gallery down the road is not. And I think, you know, even according to UBS's annual art report or any of these other annual reports that come out, you know, gallery sales make up more than half of the sales that take place in the art world. So it's like trying to call balls and strikes, if you think about the stock market, of like, well, you know, technology stocks are down, so the whole economy is going to shit. Well, no, there's also energy stocks and healthcare stocks and utilities and all types of other things that make up the portfolio of the market. And we're looking at one segment and trying to prognosticate. Is that a word?
Diagnose.
Yeah, diagnose this market just based on, you know, a 50% visibility. So I always say proceed with caution when you say that the art world is in trouble, because the art world is not a monolithic market. It's a highly fragmented, siloed, individualized thousands or tens of thousands of individual markets that take place.
Yeah, I agree. And as you always like to remind me, it's smaller than the adhesives industry. So, I mean, the art world is as important as we think we are and as big as the numbers sound like they are. It's really so tiny.
It's a drop in a bucket. So, since we dropped the last episode, you guys have been in my DMs, in our email inboxes, talking about the Lisa Schiff affair. This week at Freeze, can't tell you how many conversations I had about this ongoing legal story. And I want to start off this segment by just raising my hand and doing a little mea culpa and just say, when we discussed it last week, I felt like maybe I was underplaying maybe the seriousness of this and not understanding that and I'll get into it, what happened. But what the plaintiffs are accusing Lisa Schiff of seems to have some real teeth. And I made assumptions that I felt at the time with the facts that I had were in my purview of having. But since things have come out, I can say I've read, and we'll get into it, all the documents that have subsequently came out. And I have a new perspective and I want to share it with you guys. Mm-hmm. So a quick recap for those who didn't listen to last week's episode. One of the top art advisors in the art world, bar none, Lisa Schiff, who runs an art advisory, she has a space in Tribeca, was accused in the New York Supreme Court by two collectors, Candace Barash, Richard Grossman, of fraud. I'm just going to sum it up with fraud. There's a couple of her charges in there. The first initial court case that was filed was on May 11th, so about 10 days ago. Within that summons, that's the information we had at the time, was a single filing that the plaintiffs and their lawyer made against Lisa in the courts. We read through it, all the articles that came out about it, and basically Lisa stiffing them on payment for selling an Adrian Genny painting. Mm-hmm. It was through Sotheby's. We thought maybe there was something going on with Sotheby's. We insinuated out. Well, since that filing, and
I just want to say, for any of our detractors from the last episode, of course, you know, this this podcast has an element of humor and sarcasm and irony. I guess I have to remind people of that. But also, like, let's not forget, like, we do live in America, and if we do uphold any of the American ideals, there's one that is quite important, which is innocent until proven guilty. And she isn't even technically proven guilty yet, though the documents that have been released are quite damning. I would say that when we were just reading these initial articles that were all regurgitating the same kind of information over and over again, it wasn't spelling out very much. So it felt a lot like a pile-on. And for me personally, I wasn't comfortable just piling on to Lisa until we knew more, you know, and making things sound and feel worse than they were. Of course, there were some amusing things like the infamous "know that I love you" text and stuff like in stuff such as that. But we really didn't want to cast this shadow over Lisa as somebody who was guilty until we knew more.
Right. We didn't want to just pile on. We wanted to have our own discussion about it. And let's not forget, this whole thing started because of a, as plain as it comes, art flipping scheme, right? So what the plaintiffs are accusing Lisa of is fucking them over on a pure art flipping scheme where they all fractionally owned a single painting that they never would intended to bring into their house, that they always planned to exit within a year or two. Mm-hmm. And that's where this whole thing stemmed from. So let's not act like this was, you know, some egregious, you know, she fucked over a nonprofit.
A child's charity.
Yeah,
for curing
I mean, this
cancer.
Is an art flipping scheme that took place. So as alluded, we had an initial summons that was filed with the courts. By the way, guys, all this stuff is publicly available. You can literally read the briefings and everything that these guys filed with New York State. On May 11th, the lawyer for the plaintiffs, I think her name is Wendy Lindstrom, filed the initial summons. Since then, there has been a number of interesting filings. One includes a notice of bankruptcy. So since this filing has come out, this suit, Lisa has started to wrap up SFA Advisory, which is the business name for her operation, through the process of bankruptcy. Not great. Mm-hmm. Further, the lawyers for the plaintiffs have begun to submit exhibits, evidence, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Two of them are quite important. We have affidavits by Candace Barash and Richard Grossman, which are testimony.
Sworn testimony.
Under perjury. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is heavy stuff. I mean, everything they put in here, they're opening themselves up to perjury charges if they're lying. And it gets pretty juicy.
I love the juice. Pour me a glass of juice.
So I'm going to go through some of the statements that we learned from the subsequent filings. One of the things that came out in the first summons, which went into more detail on the affidavits, was that these plaintiffs really had a problem with the Lisa's lifestyle and what she spent money on. And because they were being stiffed on money, they really used this to highlight some really detailed things. For example, October 2022, while Candace and Schiff were traveling in Europe for Freeze London and Paris Plus, Schiff spent over 25,000 euros in a single visit to Loewe in Paris for 17 items, including a single pair of leggings for 600 euros, a dress for 5,000 euros, and a pair of ripped baggy jeans for 980 euros. And not only did she outline those, but in the exhibit, Candace placed the receipt from Loewe that somehow she had her hands on and outlined all of the spending that took place there. One thing that was in the testimony that I found slightly uncomfortable, I'm curious your take, is that the plaintiffs made it a point to name the private school that Schiff's children attend and the tuition costs. You could have just said private school. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you got to name specifically which school they go to, but, you know, I guess to each his own and how you want to approach this.
I guess it's to really drive home the look how expensive the school is point or something.
Yeah, one of the highlighted things, and I think this is really juicy. I'm going to read this to you. This is good. On the morning of Monday, May 8th, which actually is a very important day May 8th in this whole story is the day that the plaintiffs allege that Lisa called the plaintiffs and told them, I don't have the money. I'm in over my ski tips on debt. I don't have your money. I'm sorry. I'm going to make it up to you. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, text exchanges, verbal rehashing of what those conversations were. And the call on May 8th included the following. So Schiff said she had dug herself into a large financial hole that she could not get out of, that this had been going on for many years, and that she had considered filing for bankruptcy prior to COVID. But she didn't because she was afraid of a criminal investigation at that time. Again, guys, this is under perjury. This is what the plaintiffs are alluding to. Schiff claimed she had intended to map out a plan to get her out of her financial hole during her stay in rehab in San Francisco that she went to in January 2020 for her addiction to Chardonnay.
So Lisa liked a Chardy party.
She had a Chardonnay addiction that I think this was in Candace's testimony that she highlighted.
I think that is very cutting to be accused of a Chardonnay addiction. I mean, you could have said alcoholism or just an addiction problem.
It sounds like
she was addicted to lifestyles of the rich and famous. That's what it sounds like she was addicted to.
Not the Chardonnay call.
But the Chardonnay call, because as we all know, Chardonnay, and in particular an oaky Chardonnay, is very mid-90s, like early to mid-90s. It's kind of a cringe thing to be addicted to. It would be different. I don't you feel it would be different if it was like a Sancerre addiction?
Yeah, Chablis addiction, yeah. Champagne.
Something more contemporary. But in particular, a Chardonnay addiction is so specific. And, you know, when you – I've never gone to a rehab for alcoholism, but I'm pretty sure when you do your intake, they don't say, like, what are you addicted to? I'm addicted to Chardonnay. I don't think that's the statement. And also, the rehab itself was exorbitantly expensive. It sounds like a vacation.
$100,000, according to Barash.
$100,000 vacation to stop drinking Chardonnay in San Francisco, which is right near winemaking country.
Napa.
The irony. So, I don't know. It was just very, very bitchy to call out the Chardonnay thing. And also, I have some very dear friends who work in the art world who are all gallerinas who are well into their career at this point. So I don't know if they get the gallerinas anymore. They're just gallerists. But they all joke, and they have had this long-term thing about the Chardy party, which is just – are getting white wine wasted. That's another thing that they used to say. It's kind of prior to the like rosé all day or the what is it like rosé drunk or get rosé wasted or what is the phrase? Yeah,
I've heard white girl wasted.
White girl wasted.
Yeah.
It was definitely like an early white girl wasted statement to be like Chardy party or wasted because – I don't know if you know this. Do you know why they serve white wine at gallery openings?
No.
Okay. It's pretty simple. White wine, champagnes, and clear spirits. It's usually very simple. It's because people, when you have hundreds of people in your gallery, and I learned this the hard way, and you serve a red and a white, inevitably you get red wine on the wall. You get red wine on artwork. You get red wine everywhere when you serve it. But white wine is less visible to the eye. And if a little white wine gets on a painting, so be it. It just adds to the provenance of it. But if you get red wine on a painting, you've got to either call the artist back or you've got to get somebody in to handle the painting and fix it without messing up the painting itself. So that is why you always will see white wine being served.
Very interesting. I was not aware of that.
Art gallery. Yeah.
So, you know, all these things that they're outlining in these affidavits, so far, you know, spending a lot of money at Loewe or having a Chardonnay addiction is not a crime. But what I've left out so far is that they really outlined exactly what's been going on with this Genny painting, this specific issue, but also for the years going back with, I counted about 15 other works of art that these guys specifically are claiming that they were fucked over with or on.
So it was them that were fucked over on multiple paintings.
So I didn't mention this before, but a second lawsuit was also filed in addition to this original one, mm-hmm. 3 days ago. And that was alleging more about the other types of things that took place. Going back 15 years, there's a publicly available list of the artworks that... So here's how it worked. Here's the scheme, I guess, what they're alleging. So what is claimed by the plaintiffs here is that Lisa would say, hey, I got this painting that I have a chance to get us. It's at David Kordansky Gallery. It's from this artist. You know, wire me $200,000. I'll go and get it and we'll have it. We'll put it in storage and we'll sell it in a few years. What the plaintiffs are accusing is that she would take the $200,000 and never buy the painting.
Hmm.
And last week I brought up, how do you do a Ponzi scheme as an art advisor? It's that. It's really that. So if I tell you I'm buying a painting with your money and I collect your $200,000, maybe I use that $200,000 to fund my lifestyle, but also maybe to pay off someone else. I owe, you know, mm-hmm. just robbing Peter to pay Paul again instead of actually owning the artwork and going through the process. That said, it's not like I know people that have Lisa has bought artwork from. It's not like she never buys artwork. She very clearly does. But it seems like in these instances, there's an image here. If you want, I can read some of the artists and the prices that, you know, they're alleging that were problems. It was, you know, a Wangechi Mutu sculpture for $252,000, $390,000 for a Sarah Lucas sculpture, $180,000 for Alvaro Barrington work, Lauren Halsey, $110,000. This goes back for a long time. And here it's, you know, about 15 works of art.
It's a lot of hot, wet art, but yeah.
Which they're alleging basically that she didn't buy them and she took the money for them and said that they had owned them. That's breach of conflict, fraud. And it seemed to have boiled up in this Genny situation where they felt the need to bring the suit. And I would say, reading through, and I've been through all these exhibits, I think there are now 18 documents in this court case. It's very thought out. They must have been working on it for a long time. This wasn't put together in a weekend. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like they had been preparing for this, and maybe the Genny was the final straw, and then they were off to the races.
Yeah. As people who once called each other friends, this must be painful for everyone involved, but especially the people that are suing her, because if this went on for however many of those additional works were, and the Genny was sort of the tipping point, and clearly these people were traveling together, sharing meals together, riding on planes, mm-hmm. trains, going across Europe, to realize that you've just been lied to your face. Somebody's been lying to your face for years, and maybe they had an inkling but didn't want to confront her because they were all spending so much time together, especially Barash. What's her
Candace,
name?
Yeah.
Candace, who was claiming that, you know, at one point she was her sister in arms for buying art. It must be so painful, because you'd have to be so pissed. And now I understand why they went nuclear.
Yeah. I mean, in the second case, that summons, that first page, what they really did was do a full court press on her character, quoting her in articles in CNN, ArtNet, et cetera, and saying, this is how Lisa publicly displays her, you know, transparency lean and her how she's so trustworthy and how she believes in democratizing art and doing right by the artists and collectors. And here's what's actually going on. Here are the facts that we have. So they were quoting articles.
Yeah.
They said they brought up our boy Leo DiCaprio. They were like, Lisa was trusted because, quote, she catered to the art needs of global celebrities such as Leonardo DiCaprio. So okay. They really went after.
Exactly. And also, side note to all of that. So a favorite pastime of pretty much everyone in the art world, and this is one of Matt's particular pet peeves. I love to watch him get very angry about it when we're in public.
What is it?
Is when people just incessantly name drop.
Oh, my God.
Right? And people will name drop indexically, encyclopedically, you know, do you know so-and-so, so-and-so? And of course, it would never be like Leonardo DiCaprio. It would be like Leo, you know, assuming that you know and making you go that extra mile to put the pieces together exactly who is being discussed. And I have to say, here is the evidence, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't matter, this name-dropping game that so many people hold dear to their hearts, just like dropping the name of an institution or dropping the name of a fancy curator or a fancy gallery doesn't mean anything. You really need to know the people that you're working with and the character of the people you're working with. And even then, it can be very difficult because you spend an immense amount of time with them. And then guess what? They were, you know, taking your money and going shopping with it.
Yeah. Look, I think I want to just go through a couple more of these things. What they've done now is filed with Lisa's bank for records of spending transactions and wires coming in. So this is their way of getting financial evidence, which is really serious. They have motioned to have her, Lisa be deposed under, you know, perjury, oath.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Lisa Schiff Fine Art, the bank records, everything, which is her art advisory company. Like, they're doing the full court press. I used that before, but they're really pinning her. They've asked the court to effectively freeze her assets right now. Everything from her and the business's assets, no money coming in, out, can't sell anything, just completely tie her up.
Interesting, because I did see a woman at Freeze who was standing in front of a Ronnie Horn with a dealer and a client. And I really thought it was her.
There were reports that Lisa was, quote, in hiding, not answering anybody. She did shutter her gallery. That was another report. And she did file for bankruptcy.
Okay, so then it probably wasn't her, because I thought I saw her.
Who knows?
I could be wrong.
So we don't know, but it would be very wild for her to have shown up at Freeze.
I don't know. You know what? You would be surprised at how, what's that word? Shameless? How shameless people can be in this business. I have definitely seen people accused and basically proven to be guilty of worse, still trying to get back in the game over and over again. So that's why I assumed it could be her, but I could be wrong. It could have just been another art advisor that just looked a lot like Lisa. You know, one other thing I have to say that's very rude. Somewhere in all of the briefings, they list – this is mean. They list her weight.
Oh, I have that here. Yeah.
Don't read it over there. I feel as a woman, that is so not – okay.
Yeah.
In woman land, that's like, I don't know what's ruder, to be like, how much do you weigh or how old are you? I think how much do you weigh is ruder. They listed her weight.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's tough. The only thing, this is really kind of important to know. So Jerry and I are going through this. This is the evidence we have currently in front of us. Again, the allegations under oath by the plaintiffs are super serious, that she was engaging in fraud, making them pay for paintings that she was not buying. They have the lists of them. The defendants, you know, here, I'll just read this to you. This is a summary of basically what they're accusing. Schiff and her companies have been engaged in a massive fraud on their clients, which in this case involved the paintings, remitting millions of dollars to Schiff to pay in full for art purchases, which defendants, Lisa, never transmitted to the gallery selling the works. Likewise, the defendants, Lisa, failed to remit the proceeds of sales of the plaintiff's artworks. Instead, Lisa used the funds to spoil themselves with luxury travel, shopping sprees, or pay obligations owed to other clients. That's the Ponzi scheme thing. Or to purchase artworks for other clients. I had this conversation with a dealer recently, and we were talking about, again, this week, we were talking about Lisa Schiff and this idea of robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, man, you might have to ask some galleries how they manage their cash flow.
Yeah.
Because this is not an uncommon thing that galleries have bills and they take funds in, they owe money to artists, and they might, you know, use that money instead of paying the artist quickly to pay off operating expenses, overhead,
stuff,
et cetera, and then hope to make it up to that artist with the sale of a future painting that's unrelated.
Yeah.
This is not crazy. I would not advocate for this, but I'm sure this is a practice that is done. However, it seems like Lisa went kind of really overboard with. I'll say that we have, again, 18 filings, 19 if you count the new case that's opened up. That's more broad, not just the Genny, but, you know, more generally other works. Lisa's lawyer, John Cahill, who I mentioned last week, is a pretty badass, big-time lawyer in the art world, has filed only one document, the case. And it effectively saying, hey, defendant Lisa acknowledges that this summons in this case is filed. You know, she will cooperate, et cetera, but that she will answer or make a move against these complaints on or before June 15th. So basically asking for a little bit more time to get her story straight and to do the appropriate filings.
Right.
Because it seems like the plaintiffs here had a head start and were really planned and have been like blitzing the court with summons, filings, motions, all that stuff. Any wrap-up thoughts on this? It's a moving target. We'll keep you guys updated. We won't be sycophants with it. We're not going to start a Lisa Schiff Affairs podcast.
Yeah, it's not
true crime, but I think this is a big story.
Yeah, it won't be as big as the Gwyneth Paltrow skiing debacle and her subsequent Gwynning. However, we will keep you up to date on this. And, you know, as somebody who does not know Lisa personally, just knows of her by reputation prior to this and via some friends who have worked with her, I personally never had anything against her, and it saddens me, but it also, in this industry, it's so difficult. It is so difficult. There really is a scarcity mentality. I'm not making up for what she said, but there's a scarcity mentality. And then there's this keeping up with the Jones thing.
The lifestyle.
And I think that galleries get sucked up into it just as much as artists do, just everyone. Because when you're working with people who are so wealthy, you don't want to feel below them.
No, you have to be on their level.
So you want to sort of level with them, especially as an art advisor, hence the $25,000 a month apartment. And
if you're going to trust me, I on Wall Street, there's this thing where you got to get a watch or you got to get a nice watch. And that whole reason is when you go to client meetings, you at least have to check that box.
Right.
That you have the Rolex or whatever, a nice one. Can't be one that everyone else has. You have to have like
a special one.
Right. And it's just this little indicator to your clients, who are typically people of wealth, that you are in their stratosphere.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what's happening, right?
Yeah. And so this is not to take, again, this is not to take her side. This is just a ounce of empathy and understanding of how a person can get so caught up in something like that. And at a certain point, I think we all delude ourselves. I mean, I know I do. I don't steal.
Careful.
But I know that when I go to certain, you know, when I go to Switzerland, for example, and I'm amidst people who are hundreds of, not thousands of times more wealthy than I am, do I want to be dressed, you know, on a similar level? Do I want to bring forth my best version of myself, my most healthy, radiant, glowing, you know, thought out presentation of myself? Yes, I do, because I don't want to feel less than, because we are we are humans that have pack mentality, and we like to, you know, what's it called? We're tribal. And we want to look alike, sound alike, feel like we belong. And when you're around people who have a different level of wealth than you, I can see and I can understand, and I have even felt it at times, where you want to fit in. You don't want to look like the charity case that they're just hanging out with because, you know, they feel sorry for you. At a certain point, if you're in long enough, you want to be at their level.
Right.
And I'm sure that once you sort of quote unquote get there and you do start establishing some wealth, it becomes a little bit of an addiction to keep up with that lifestyle when in fact you should have probably, Lisa or anybody in this situation should, don't, in terms of displaying wealth, don't even bother trying to keep up because you can't. Just be yourself and be really good at your job. And, but again, if she was going on luxury art buying trips with these very wealthy collectors for weeks at a time, you're traveling and you want to eat at the same places, stay at the same hotel,
dress the same,
dress in this a similar manner, ride in the same kind of transportation, you want a private car instead of taking a train, whatever. Again, I'm not making an excuse, but you can understand how a person's psychology can get to
right. It's incentives. You can clearly see that it made sense why someone would want to pursue that. But, you know, we both agree that
the
means by which you do that need to be ethical and legal.
Yes.
And I think hopefully that this kind of story is a calling or a siren to people out there that are being a little loosey-goosey with their cash flow, right? That gallery situation I described earlier, I'm sure if I ask around, I'll find out a lot of galleries are operating that way. Art advisors, probably. But be careful out there. Just because the art world is unregulated, quote unquote, doesn't mean that crimes like fraud, breach of contract,
it's becoming you. More regulated, I have to say. I mean, we saw that with the Michael Shufu Huang thing last year when, which gallery was it?
Paula Cooper
went after and won, or settled.
Settled. In effect, won, but.
But I mean, the art world is becoming more professionalized, and with professionalism comes a litigious element. And I think that is the first thing that people are really going to start trying to clean up is all of these breaches of contract, because the art world for years and years, even when I first came into it, which was in the span of things not that long ago, was very handshaky. It was very, you know, contracts, non-resale contracts, all these new sort of things that are being implemented. Galleries didn't have HR departments. I mean, I to explain how unprofessional it really is beyond the pale. Just assume it hasn't been professionalized at all. It's been the Wild West and it's been cowboys, you know, with a gun in their, with their hand on their gun ready to draw, but then like spitting in the other hand, sticking their hand out ready to shake, you know? And it's kind of been like this for a long time. And I think now all of a sudden the industry has grown enough. not like the adhesives industry.
No.
But it has grown enough to where people will come down on you and will follow up with you in court if you steal from them.
Yep. So we will keep you guys updated. What I'm really interested in doing is maybe a part three of this saga of the Lisa Schiff affair. Is I'll keep track of when she presents her side of the story, which to date, we have not heard whatsoever. What we do have is sworn affidavits from the plaintiffs with some really damning shit, and it's really bad. Mm-hmm. And if Lisa is guilty of these things, if it goes to court, if it is adjudicated, then that's potential prison time.
Yeah.
And that's really, really scary for her. So I just want to, you know, we have to at least present her side of the case here.
Yeah.
Because as you stated eloquently in the beginning of this, in this country, you are innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah. And one more thing I just want to say, not to beat a dead horse, but about this whole, oh, she was Leo's art advisor.
Right.
So hence, we must trust her. Mm-hmm. Recently, I had a friend. I'm not going to name any names because it's actually friends working with friends. I was out of this situation, just observing in. But a friend of mine
had a gallery, had a painting in a group show. And a fake collector came in or emailed under like a fake name, fake this, pretended to be like a TV or a movie producer in Hollywood. The dealer, the gallerist, Googled this person, assumed everything was fine, sent them the invoice. They sent like a fake wire, mm-hmm. or sent a document saying the wire had been sent, but they didn't actually receive the money in their bank account.
We call that the Anna Delvey. Yeah.
And so they sent an art handler, quote unquote art handler, to come and take this painting out of the gallery when it hadn't been paid for, which means the painting got literally stolen. Mm-hmm. Painting was stolen. And I, of course, feel awful for my friend whose painting got stolen because it's a massive violation. Just as an artist, your work gets stolen. But, you know, the dealer, the person that sold it, who's also somebody I know very well and who has a good reputation and has worked within this industry, I think their fatal flaw in enabling the situation to happen was, oh, you say your name is so-and-so, Google. Oh, you make films in Hollywood and you dropped, what's in your collection? What else do you collect? Oh, well, that's quite easy to answer.
Check.
You could just say a bunch of names. Oh, you have all these things in your collection and you're this big Hollywood producer who's made some Marvel movies or whatever it is. Absolutely, we'll sell to you. And, you know, the standard or the background checks or the whatever, it actually needs to be even more professionalized, I think, at this point.
I would say, have you ever heard of the phrase KYC?
No.
It stands for Know Your Client.
Oh.
It's a protocol, compliance protocol that every industry adheres to when they're selling, you know, things to, like banks, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a cartel guy can't open up a checking account at Chase.
Can in Switzerland, but.
But because they do, they have a KYC team. And I'll say to Christie's defense, and Christie's allows people to bid, they are required to do a KYC check. They're going to check your driver's license, your passport, make sure you're not a sanctioned individual, make sure you're not, you know, wanted under arrest, make sure you're a real person. Like KYC protocols are very common in tons of industries when you're selling things at high dollar amounts. How do we get to KYC on this?
Because we're just talking about...
Yeah, vetting, right? Vetting, so people were like, yeah. Lisa worked with him. Oh, okay.
Worked boom. With Leo. Oh, must be great. Must be perfect. And actually, no.
No one's perfect.
No.
So we talked about we wanted to do a little bit on the Andy Warhol Supreme Court ruling. However, I think that that's such a meaty topic, and we've already gotten through so much on this episode that I feel like we got to give it its proper due.
Yeah.
Because there's a broader conversation around artists' intellectual property rights, particularly related to artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I think that requires
a
lot more, yeah. Not just the last few minutes of this week's podcast. So,
but I will say, and I'm excited, let's get into it maybe next week. But I am very interested to follow up with it, reason being, you know, appropriation truly is a part of the Western canon and is a red thread mm-hmm. that goes through art history. And there's amazing artists like Sturtevant, Elaine Sturtevant, who was appropriating artists in real time. She was known to even sometimes beat artists to their own before their own opening of their own show and appropriate their work and put on an exhibition of an appropriation of their exact exhibition, but open it like a day earlier and like really piss off like Klaus Oldenburg in this, you know, 70s, 60s, 70s. Andy Warhol gave her full permission, gave her old green prints and was like, appropriate away. You know, so
that was part of her practice.
Yeah, and one could even argue Duchamp, right? The initial king of appropriation, taking a toilet, or sorry, a urinal.
And, yeah, get it right.
And calling it the fountain and writing Our Mutt on it, and then suddenly it's
perfume bottles
recontextualized in a different way. And then there's little old Jerry Gagosian over here, who a lot of other people who've been making memes, right? And or music. Music is constantly an appropriation of itself over and over again. That's sort of how music evolves. If you listen to hip hop, for example, I don't listen to tons of it, but I think it's funny sometimes because I listened to a lot of it when I was a teenager. And sometimes I'll get into like an Uber or something and they'll have the radio on and it'll be like contemporary hip hop. And I'll hear like current DJs mixing in like little sound bites or using beats from songs that were popular when I was a teenager that I can recognize. And then it actually, if you go backwards, you're like, oh, but that actually comes from a hip hop song from the 80s or the 90s. So appropriation is sort of built into this idea of how we make contemporary art. So it'll be interesting to digest this ruling.
Right.
Only because it will disturb the sort of natural development of what contemporary art has become. And so I wonder, you know, the art world hasn't, it used to be way more punk. It's not punk at all. Now it's very becoming professionalized.
That's Coachella.
Yeah. But I wonder if people are going to adhere to this or if this is going to be something that causes people to rebel even further.
So there's a lot to unpack on this ruling, and to do it justice, we want to give it more of a time. But I think the way we should do this is we should give our listeners a small, brief homework assignment.
Okay.
Because next week we are going to hit this topic. So great guy, great writer, and friend of the podcast, very close friend, Mr. Blake Gopnik, put out a piece of analysis on the New York Times about this ruling, the Supreme Court's decision over Andy Warhol's use of Lynn Goldsmith's Prince photograph. Let's link it in the bio. Let's analyze it ourselves. Let's make sure the audience has some time to read and reflect on it. And then we'll get into it next week.
Yeah, let's do that.
So I'll link it in the bio so you guys can see it. Shout out to Blake.
Hey, Blake, we miss you.
Jerry, it's plug time. We're wrapping up this episode. This was a fun one.
Yeah.
It's pretty juicy. What do you got going on?
As usual, after a big, it was basically a 2-week sprint like that, we're going to have a very good Jerry report. Each one is always a little different. This one, because we kind of went over some of my general feelings about Freeze, this report is going to be very special. The reason it's going to be special is I'm dedicating this report to the senior director.
The senior director.
So we're going to be doing a sort of I'm going to write a literary masterpiece which outlines the characteristics of the quintessential senior director and, you know, everything from how they dress, how they speak, how they work, how they move through the world. And I dedicate it to all my favorite senior directors out there in the world, AKA my spirit animals.
Subject of many a Jerry Gagosian meme as well.
Yes. So, you know, there's always a meme about the senior director. They're just very special flowers in this universe that it's time to write sort of a full...
The ode.
Ode to the senior director.
We're all looking forward to that. So make sure you go to Gagosian.com to subscribe and get the latest version of the Jerry Report, which will be out soon. All right, guys. This has been Art Smack, episode 25. Leave us 5 stars. Leave a review. Appreciate the listen. See you guys later.
See you on the internet.